You okay, Rina? You seem stressed. What's going on?
Do you ever feel that parenting a disabled child is chaos, like absolute paperwork chaos? There's just so much admin on top of caring for your kids. It's like I'm my freaking daughter's PA.
Ah, yes. You should try the new Hibby app.
An app?
Not just any app, it's Disabled Parenting Mega PA organization. So you can schedule appointments, have reminders for your medication, have all of their medical notes and letters in just one place.
Hang on, spell this out to me again.
Hibby, Hibi. It's a disabled parenting organization app. I wish I'd had it when B was younger. It gives me a sense of control over, well, the uncontrollable.
Sounds intriguing. Who doesn't want to organize disabled parenting chaos one notification at a time?
Haha, yes, it's my new sidekick. Sidekicking the shit out of disabled parenting organization.
That's the least catchy strapline I've ever heard, Lauren.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. They won't want it. But if you, like Rena and I, want to give it a go, you can download Hibby for free on the App Store now. In this episode, we talked with Juliet Dina, a dance movement psychotherapist, and it's a slightly different episode where we touched upon Juliet's own personal story, but we also really spent a lot of time picking her brains on what makes her organization, the organization she runs called I Can Dance, so special and what it means to really truly build a community around the space of disabled children and their entire families. I really love talking to Julia. Well, how about you, Rina?
I loved it. I love Juliet anyway, having known her
We
through dance.
love
We love you. But I think it was just so interesting because obviously I know Juliet just through Lua and taking her to the I Can Dance, but actually speaking to her and understanding her ideologies about parenting a disabled kid. Lua's needs are so great, and wherever I've taken her, even school or like getting onto the school transport system, whatever, has been such an issue because of all of her expenditures and all of her
Medical
accessories.
accessories, yeah.
Yeah. And it's always been such a foo-far, but with I Can Dance and with Juliet in particular, it's I took her in, they kind of looked at her and looked at her needs and were like, yeah, that's absolutely fine. We can get everybody trained. It's not a problem. And I was just gobsmacked that it was so seamless, so easy. They weren't terrified of Lua or her needs. So,
Oh.
yeah, it's incredible what they do.
Yeah, I agree. And Juliet herself, I mean, she certainly chatting with her for this episode, it really reminded me of like the importance of that human touch and interaction and being playful and musical with our children. It's something I try to be better at with my kids. And also, I think she talks about learning to just be. Not necessarily do and meet your child or young person where they are. It's not always easy to remember to do that, but so important and powerful to be able to do that actually, for everybody, for
100%.
ourselves as well. I think, yeah, as much as the whole dance psychotherapy experience is amazing for children, I think movement is really good for us as well. It's like freeing
Oh, God, yeah.
that release, like to dance around your kitchen or your
Yes.
living room or whatever. It's sort of so you can reminisce about, the more carefree days that we once had.
Raving at the clubs at 3 a.m.
You maybe.
Oh.
So I hope people enjoy listening.
Yeah, enjoy.
This is the Fucking Normal Podcast, the cheers, tears, and Friday night beers of parenting disabled children.
I'm Rena.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're both mothers to daughters with special needs. Parenting a disabled child can often feel difficult to navigate. If this is you, you're not alone. We're here to share unique parenting stories and chat about the things that we've learnt and are still learning.
Prepare to sometimes laugh, sometimes cry, but hopefully leave with a shot of optimism in your arm. And don't forget, we are talking from a parent's perspective. We would never presume to talk on behalf of a disabled child or adult. So expect bad language and, quite frankly, some brutal honesty.
Because really, what the fuck is normal anyway?
Wake me up, loud as clouds, all my love for you.
Juliette Dina is a mother, an academic, and a dance movement psychotherapist. She is founder and CEO of the charity I Can Dance. With a background in special educational needs, teaching and dance, Juliette founded I Can Dance in 2006 with a desire to build an inclusive community where dance was accessible for all.
Subsequently influenced by her own personal journey, it's a joyful and inclusive place of community that, full disclosure, both Lauren and I's daughters go. Juliette is also currently completing a doctorate focused on the I Can Dance approach. Hello, Juliette.
Hi, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Can we start by jumping straight in and talking about what is dance movement psychotherapy? I'm intrigued because I have no clue what that means.
Well, I think what's so amazing about it is that we're living it every day. We are using our bodies to understand and experience the world. And in a way, we create our own patterns, our own ways of being, our own creative responses to what it is to be in the world. And dance movement psychotherapy is about relying on how the body receives messages, how the body understands what it is to be in relationship, how the body explores being in the world, and how what goes on internally manifests itself through the body. And that we explore that a little bit more with being creative in the body, and that it is about exploring it through dance, but dance movement psychotherapy doesn't always look like you're creating a dance, but we have a dance through life. Mm. And that's very much what dance movement psychotherapy is about.
Oh, that's beautiful. Dancing through life. Yeah. Love that.
We should all dance like about through life more. Literally. Anyway, shouldn't we? We should be thinking of life like that. That's beautiful.
I think that's how we start.
Yeah.
Think about children, every child, no matter what, they explore through their bodies. That's how they begin in life. It's all about a mother's touch, a mother's gaze, a mother's help, being held by a mother. And so often as we become adults, or as what we see as developing in the world, we become more cognitive and we focus just on the thinking and on the words. And I think we then sort of forget how valuable it is to work through our senses or through the body as a means and as a tool of understanding the world around us. Mm. So we're doing it all the time. Let's just not forget that it's there.
Yeah,
that's amazing. So tell us a little bit about I Can Dance and the process of that and why you started it in the first place.
Well, maybe to understand why I started I Can Dance, I can tell you a little bit about my journey.
Yeah,
and I suppose since I can remember, I have danced. Since I can remember, I explored the world through moving and creating. As my family tell me, I used to sort of climb up on the table and dance for everybody and insist that they watch them. So it was obviously a drama bean. And my mother loved to dance. And so she took me to dance. And it just clicked. Something just clicked for me. And so I danced, didn't just become a hobby. It became my focus. And I then trained specifically in dance and went to very formalized training and process. And sort of really realized that dance was what made me feel complete. Dance was what made me feel who I was. The dancing world is also a very painful world, and it can be a very challenging world because dance is very focused on traditional dance anyway, perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I then also realized very quickly that my body is not perfect. My body didn't necessarily meet what it needed to do always, and then work with that, which I realized became very much part of my story. I then continued to do all sorts of different kinds of dance, and then realized, okay, I wanted to take dance more into a sort of teaching and learning and educating beyond performing, and then trained as a ballet teacher. But alongside that, I also then did a degree in teaching. And just because I've always wanted to teach, and so I trained as a school teacher, a mainstream school teacher, taught in South Africa, and then sort of came over here. And then I was teaching in schools and then started exploring more special education needs schools, and expanded myself more and more. But then would still be teaching ballet and in dance schools in the evenings and on the weekends. And then as I became more involved in SEN and I was a Senko for a few years, I realized there was something I didn't, something about living these two worlds, a world that was creative and exploratory and using my body, and a world that was very much about targets and sitting at a desk and working with kids, and it just didn't feel quite right. And I also realized that a lot of the young people I was working with had real emotional barriers to, they couldn't even get into the room, never mind me start trying strategies with them. And that's when I discovered dance movement psychotherapy. And that for me brought all my worlds together. It's like, oh, okay, there's this place where you can use movement as a tool, where you, dance becomes this opportunity. And it's an added strategy, and it's a way of connecting on the inside before we start thinking about the outcome. It's more process focused. So then I had all these various hats, and I've sort of moved between these hats. And then I can dance sort of evolved for me as I was exploring these various hats. I thought, no, but what does it look like if it all came together? And that's very much what I've developed at I Can Dance, this way of thinking both, yes, we need to think about how are we learning, but then using the tools of and creativity of dance, but then thinking about, in order to do that, what's going on internally for this young person? And so really thinking what I've sort of classed as the well-being, the creativity and the learning, which is the approach that I Can Dance embodies.
Just to give those who don't know it a bit more of a feel, who's it for? Who are the young children and young adults that are involved in I Can Dance, and what does it encompass?
So I founded I Can Dance in 2006. And really it was this idea that I felt, I absolutely believe in the power of dance. I believe it not just as this great fun thing to do, but as I've named, as a tool, as a strategy, a way of connecting, a way of being, a way of expressing. And because I, at that stage, and still am, you know, had really developed my thinking within the disability community, it became about making it possible for disabled young people. I became very aware that young people with a variety of needs just didn't have the same access to these creative opportunities, and it just felt wrong. And so that, for me, the focus was creating it within the disabled community, and it's now extended and beyond. And for me, I think ideally I started it for the child, and now it's for the family, and it's for the community. And that's, for me, what I Can Dance is about. It's a means of bringing us together. It's a means of overcoming differences and doing it in a very creative, non-threatening way.
Is that why it's such, you're so focused on like building the community? Because you realise that we don't have much of a community.
So we're in a similar boat, I guess. That's the reason we started this podcast, is community is so important in that kind of, both for the children and also for the parents.
Was that why? I mean, I think what you said is it initially started for the kids, but it's now gone on and developed so into something much bigger than that.
Yeah, and it feels right. And I realize that the more I've sort of explored what I Can Dance is and why I started it, I realized that started with my own desire to build community. And that comes from me growing up in South Africa. And I feel that the African spirit is very much about community. And actually just recently I conducted some research about, as I'm doing along with my doctorate. And one of the biggest things that came up for me is this whole Ubuntu identity, which is I am because we are. And that we cannot shape ourselves without being shaped by each other, and that we do not function in society as individuals, that we are absolutely every day directly impacting each other, the small choices to the big choices. And I think growing up with those, that African culture of that we belong, that tribal experience, which for me is really important, and I am quite tribal in the way that I build community. And I think also just growing up in a community that was very split. I grew up in the middle of apartheid. I watched Nelson Mandela walk out of prison whilst I was in secondary school. I realized that I hated living in a society that was so split, that was so in an us and them way of being, that not everyone was welcome, not everybody belonged. And then I saw that play out more and more in when I was then working as a professional here in the UK and around the world, around these pockets of you're over there and we're over here. And that's what the disabled community felt for me, that there was this divide. And I suppose for me, it's all about what does it mean to be? What does it mean to belong? What does it mean to actually do it together? Mm-hmm. And that's my focus of what Alcan Dance is about.
Wonderful. Yeah, we so enjoy being part of that community. And then in terms of your personal life, so you're a mother. You weren't a mother when you started I Can Dance, but can you just tell us a little bit more about your personal story and how that might have influenced you over the years at I Can Dance?
I think it's so interesting how we are drawn to things and never knowing actually why.
Yeah.
Until slowly you go along and then you go, oh, that's why. And I suppose that, for me, in many ways, I Can Dance is my other child. It was something that was birthed inside of me from my beliefs and my values. And then along came my children that then became part of that story as well. So my first daughter was born in 2010. And, you know, before that, you're the professional, mm-hmm. and you're sitting on one side of the table. And then I saw my daughter received a diagnosis of cystic fibrosis. And then I realized I'm now on the other side of the table.
Yeah.
And it felt really interesting to step across and to know what it feels like to be on both sides. And I feel that it has informed me and it's helped me to shape the community. Mm. It helped me to understand what it is and how we should be working and relating. We then began a journey, and that journey continued when my son was born and diagnosed as well. And I then truly understood, in a way, what it's like to manage multidisciplinary teams, mm-hmm. Manage EAC plans, you know, deal with a multitude of phone calls while still trying to find your place in the world. And I remembered one time I had a health professional come to my home, and she was looking at all the things I was trying to manage with my children, and knowing that I'm still working because I was then really building I Can Dance. And she said, why don't you just stop and just be a carer? You know, because I think that's just really what your children need. And I said, you know what? What my children need is to see me making change in the world. And it motivated me more. I made a conscious choice that I'm going to do this as well as raise my children. And my children are part of I Can Dance. They've been part of it. They've been part of the annual performances. They are invested in it. My family's invested in it because it's about community and it's about celebrating differences.
That's incredible. Wow. And yeah, kudos to you for leaning into it rather than stepping back when someone suggested it. That's not to diminish those parents that do decide, or for no other reason than they have to, become kind of full-time carers. Mm-hmm. But how do you, I guess, well, I'm intrigued, you're so emotionally invested in I Can Dance, mm-hmm. and it obviously has this now very personal emotional tie into your own family story. How do you kind of step away from that? Do you need to ever step away from all of that? I know that I personally feel sometimes, you know, when I've dabbled with becoming a speech therapist and done other things, I've found it too much because I've always seen it through the lens of B, and I've kind of thought, oh no, I need something different. I need something separate to that. Do you ever have that?
I feel that maybe because of the type of, because I'm working from a sort of psychotherapeutic frame.
Yeah.
And the people that I find myself around me are informed. They are intuitive. They are reflective. And those are the people that I gather around me. So I feel that in many ways it feeds me, as nurtures me. Yes, it also requires a lot of personal sacrifice. Yes, there are times where it has pushed me too far and I've needed to look at that and will still continue to do so.
Yeah.
But I feel that what I love about I Can Dance is that it doesn't feel like a job. Mm. I feel that it is something I was called to do. It feels that I've been given this gift and I'm a guardian of it and I'm helping shape it. Mm. And I think also as it's grown and it's developed, I realize that it's not mine. It belongs to the community. And that is what I'm constantly trying to hold, that it's held by others. It's not just held by me. And that is what I hope will give it its sustainability.
Mm. That could also feel quite freeing, because I think once you relinquish some of the responsibility and you're passing it on to the community to help build, it must be quite freeing as well.
How do you draw boundaries between your personal life then and I Can Dance? And I guess you bring a lot of empathy because of your lived experience, but it strikes me you do that in a way without going, oh, me too, I've experienced that, you know, that you are very clear about, you know, you're keeping your personal life and story kind of personal and separate to your work. How do you do that?
I think it's a really important opportunity for all of us, actually. I think that we should, so often when you're a professional and you have lived experience, you're often, you know, you need to put it away. And absolutely, in order to be in the right place as a professional, it shouldn't leak into everybody else's. Yeah. However, I really feel that it should be a resource. Mm-hmm. It should be a well of knowledge that you pull from. Not to say, oh, yes, I got it. No, but to say, I identify, or I can comprehend, or it has informed me or changed my view. And I suppose I do it like that, is that it helps to look at it gives me a few lenses to look through, and gives me an empathy of the journey that the families are going through. I think so often when I try to foster in the team, is that when we're dealing with a child or we meet a family on that day, we might see them for an hour, but there is an entire story behind that hour. And they need to hold in mind what that story is and realize that there was so much more that happened before that hour, and there will be so much more that will happen after that hour. So by holding that in mind, I think it helps us to deal with each other differently.
Mm-hmm. Completely.
Massively. Have you... because you're surrounded by parents who have such vast experience and varied experience, what have you learned from parents? Have they shaped the way that you parent your own children or how you deal with situations in your own life?
I'm constantly just so, I suppose humbled is the word, as I meet every family that I've worked with. For being in education for 25 years. I'm just humbled how everybody wants the best for their child, is working with the tool set that they were given, and trying to navigate a system that is not always as supportive as they would like. And I think I always meet them where they're at as to, so where are you? What is your story? How has your story influenced your child's story? How do you live that together as a family? And then how do we, as professionals or community members, hold that story with you? And I think that I would love it that as professionals, people thought about that more.
Oh my God, yeah. Oh my God, yeah. When everything's kind of overly, made clinical or transactional with the family, you know, you come in for an appointment for whatever it might be, a therapy or a hospital appointment, and it's like, we just need to go through, I mean, you've had this experience yourself, we just need to go through the details again. Yeah, so like relive all of that trauma or like that experience, and can you list out everything that you've been through in the last 5 years with your child right there as well. So, you know, there's a lack of context
understanding. You know what's so funny? Arbs, recently my partner has been stepping up and taking Lua to more appointments because I'm incredibly busy with work at the moment, and also I'm very happy to pass the baton to him. And he had an appointment last week and he was really upset because rocked up to the appointment and the doctor wanted the entire history. And he was like, this is the first time it's happened to him. It's happened to us a million times. But he was like, it's on her records. Why is the doctor not reading it before? It takes, 5 minutes to read it off the screen, to know our story, to then come in at a level, instead of spending the majority of the appointment talking about the past and why we've got to where we are. And I was like,
Really? This is so interesting, isn't it? It's like, there should be changes. They need to be doing this, blah, blah, blah. I was like, ah, you're late to the party. But yes.
But you see, I think that can all just be done ever so slightly differently.
Yeah.
So if the professionals thought, I need to get this history because the reason is because I need to check first it's up to date, and perhaps I need to hear it from the parents.
Yeah.
Then say so.
Yes.
Then and also really look with empathy, or look at how your body is messaging that. And I think there's such small changes that can happen to make it a warm experience and not a re-traumatizing experience.
Mm.
And I think we have a lot of times professionals are so concerned about the outcome that they forget what the process feels like and what it feels like to be that parent sitting there. And that's where I think lived experience is so helpful.
Yeah.
And then adapting that. And yes, I've got 10 minutes with you because I'm an NHS doctor and I'm oversaturated and I'm not coping with my mental health as well. I get that. But there's still really very gentle ways that we can bring more warmth and more understanding into how we work with each other.
Yeah, definitely. Completely. I mean, I would ask, it's quite a personal question, but sort of, did you find that the reverse was true? So the fact that you were trained movement psychotherapist and you obviously, you know, studied psychotherapy, understand it. When you faced that, you know, news about your daughter's diagnosis, when that sort of landed with you, did you feel, I mean, it's a bit of a kind of hypothetical question because you don't know how you would have been otherwise, but did you feel you had a toolkit almost in your professional training that allowed you to, I guess,
deal with it
in a better way than you would have otherwise?
Absolutely. I do feel that in many ways I was lucky that I've been on a journey of even just the fact that I understand education systems.
Yeah.
And that I've done years of my own personal therapy on myself.
Yeah.
Because that was part of my training.
Part of it, yeah.
I've learned what it is to talk with professionals. I know the language. And so in many ways that's helped me to really be able to fight the fight that I needed to, not just for my own children, but for I Can Dance, because I come from such an informed place and then have been open to change and becoming more and more informed. So I do feel that I had that advantage, but then also used it and refined it. And with it as well, I'm surrounded by informed friends and professionals.
Yeah, so you have a network already. Yeah.
Even if I was, because I think I was lecturing at the time. I think I was lecturing at Goldsmiths on the dance movement psychotherapy course. And so I was surrounded by like 8 therapists. So if I was having a bad day, there was definitely someone who was going to listen.
That's so handy.
So, in many ways, I was lucky. And I absolutely don't know. And perhaps that's why I place such an emphasis on the well-being for parents through I Can Dance. Because if I didn't have that, I'm not quite sure what that would have felt like to manage all these complexities that you're going through. And then also managing the complexities on the families that I'm meeting at I Can Dance. And I think, you know, lots of professionals feel saturated. They're not quite sure what to deal with a parent who comes to them that's had a traumatic experience. They don't know what to do with it.
Yeah,
I think that coming from this informed place has enabled me to feel that I can hold that with you, that parent. I can hold it with you. I can see you in your pain, and then you can go on with your day.
Yeah.
Okay. I think one of the things that I find that I'm sure, I think parents experience is quite painful, is that professionals aren't able to sit with them in their pain. It's very much about what medication you're on, you do that. But actually, when you arrive at an appointment and something's so raw, somewhere along the way, you hope that someone will acknowledge it. And I think when it's not acknowledged, that feels incredibly painful. And I think it would be really interesting to explore what it is. And that's something I'm interested in, is just what does it mean to care in a professional position, and are there ways of doing it without we're still feeling boundaried? And it's interesting because one of the values that we have as our strategy map at I Can Dance is love. And I can tell you, you don't find that in most organizations, and that you don't find the CEO of an organization saying to the team, we can think about what it is to show love, because that to me is about what it is to be human.
Mm. It's so true. You've built a community around parents and I Can Dance, but do you have a community for you separate from this to help you deal with whatever's going on in your personal life or with I Can Dance that's away from I Can Dance?
I do. I have lots of very important, special, loving, kind people in my world. Firstly, just my husband, and we're doing this together, including I Can Dance. We're doing life together, and he walks me through I Can Dance as well. And my family have been there and supported me, even though they're far. And I have some very special women friends who have their own stories, but are there when I know I need them. And then there's some who have very similar stories to mine, and some of the stories are very different.
Mm.
But I consciously seek community.
This is what we need to learn personally as well. I think a lot of us, certainly myself, didn't want that community because you feel like it's only happening to you and you're the only one who's going through mm-hmm. it or dealing with it. So for a long time, I didn't want the community. I didn't want the help. I didn't want to reach out to anybody because I didn't feel that I would be seen. However, when I was seen, then it was the big wake-up call of, why have I waited so long? Why didn't I find my Lauren in my fucking normal community? So it's such a long time ago.
It's hard, isn't it? It's hard, and I think I'm sure there'll be people listening that maybe feel, you know, it's a lot sometimes to reach out and find people. And especially in like the disabled parenting community, I think there's, you sometimes don't want to seek people with the same diagnosis picture or story because then the comparison is so in your face. And also maybe you're just not dealing with it and accepting it yet. Or, you know, you're dealing with it in your own way and you don't want to be compared to anybody else's story. Mm-hmm. But I think also then you can also feel that the comparison and your scenario is in some sort of hierarchy and that somebody who is in a different scenario wouldn't get it because I'll be blunt, they feel like, well, their child's less disabled than my child or that they don't have this to consider. My sense is with I Can Dance, it's just everybody together. Everybody's stories are different and it's about supporting and building community based on the fact that difference isn't a bad thing. We're all here. We're all human. Mm-hmm. And love is the most important thing. I think it's hard, but people need to feel that actually it's worth being a bit brave and stepping outside and trying to find that community because it's
worth it.
Find your reason.
Oil Lauren.
Yeah. God, find your Juliet.
And yeah,
you sort it. And I guess it would be really nice to hear how you think. So clearly you're very passionate about movement psychotherapy and what it can do for children and adults. Can you tell us a bit of give us a flavour of a story of a child that you've helped or a family that you've helped and what it's done for them?
One of the core principles is thinking about what's happening internally for a child and not just believing that it's a behavior. Everything that a child tells us is a communication. And I remember once a child coming and he was in the room and he kept screaming and he just kept running around and screaming. And the absolute shame that the parent had, she just had so much shame. And she just kept saying, I'll take him now. Don't worry, I'll take him. Mm. And I said to her, just give us time. Firstly, just trust. Just trust that my team, they can do it. My team can do it. And I said, let's just see what's happening for him. And then we just gave him time to sort of process, to arrive, to be in the room. The team worked with him in specific ways. And over time, we realized that the scream wasn't distress. The scream was excitement. The scream was joy. And I think so often we look at something and we think it's that. We look at the scream, we think it's distress, and we need to remove. And actually, if we stay with, we work with, we sort of feel it, work with the unconscious and say, well, what actually is happening here?
Mm.
We discover a whole different story. And how, and that's that kind of process plays out all the time. Yeah, I find it fascinating when parents phone up and ask about I Can Dance. And when I always have a personal conversation with every single parent mm-hmm. before they arrive.
Yeah.
And the first step is because I want them to know that there's someone that is truly interested in who their child is. And I want to understand them. I'm not going to get your full story, but I want you to know there's a voice behind this and that voice is looking forward to seeing you. So that's the step one of building this relationship. But how often a parent will try to explain, when I ask them about their child, they'll start explaining and then start sort of, but they're not too bad. It's okay. You'll see, they'll be fine.
Oh my gosh. And yes.
All the time. And I'll say, it's okay. This is what we do. And this isn't about your child coming and being a dancer. That's not what I Can Dance is about.
No, not at all.
This is about coming and being part of the community and us finding ways to support your child in using the way they explore the world through their body in finding their space in our community. And I'm always struck at how shocked they are that no matter the level of need of their child, that that's okay.
Yeah,
we'll work with it. We're not going to reject it.
Yeah. I think as a parent, you get so used to, you know, you paint these pictures differently depending on who you're talking to.
Oh, God, yeah.
So you know, everyone knows, well, not everyone, but most people know now if you're writing an EHCP or looking for support within the school or education system, think of your child on their worst day, you know, that horrible, which is just, oh, so difficult to write and think about. Conversely, when you're trying to get, you know, support, I don't know, like childcare or club. Yeah. Oh, this is totally man. They have no behavioural issues. you know, just kind of trying to diminish or to minimize
their issues. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think as well, you get used to putting it down on paper, what the diagnoses are, and they can look really scary on paper. And it's not about the child and knowing that child and what the child is capable of, you know. It's just about a set of labels that, you know, the systems that we rely on in health and education have put on our children.
I think that's why for me naming it as an affirmation of I Can Dance was so important. And it's become even more so as the organisation has grown.
Mm.
Because most families, when they start at the beginning of being diagnosed, it's all about what won't happen. You know, everything that's not going to happen, every milestone they're not going to reach, and all those things they're not going to do. And you're overwhelmed with a sense of the knots.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to focus on everyone can dance, I can dance, and that is what we're going to do. And we will find the way. And so the approach is about, and the way I feel that we should be approaching anything, not just working with disabled young people. So this is what I would like. This is my challenge. So what's that bit in between that's going to make it possible?
Yeah.
And who do I need on my team to help me do that bit in between? Because we shouldn't be doing it alone. It's not possible alone.
No. That's amazing. Hence the community.
Exactly. Yeah.
And have you made any mistakes? Sorry to like go from that amazing positivity to like tell us what you got wrong, but
makes you more human, Juliet.
Yeah. Have you made what mistakes have you made along the way?
I think when you're dealing with families, that you always need to know that there's more to the story. Never feel as if, well, my experience is never feel like, oh, we've got it. Oh yeah, no, we understand this child, and then all of a sudden they have a bad day and they're gone, they're running. And you're like, okay, we didn't see that coming. And that's one of the things I've really learned is always be open to being surprised. Do not think that this is the child. I think so often disabled young people are seen as one-dimensional. Oh, this is them.
Yeah.
We understand them. We got them. And I'm like, absolutely not. They are just as 3D, if not more, of like we are everyone. Their emotional growth and well-being is not determined by where they might be cognitively. Their experience of the world is just as what we're experiencing. So I think I learned very quickly, do not think, oh, I got it. We understand. We got there. We've got this strategy sorted. But no, it's just always open to change and always open to thinking differently because that's what we need.
Mm. What have you learned from the children that you deal with? If you could give us an example of something that you've learned from a particular child or experience at Eye Can Dance.
Well, I feel that every single one of them has helped shape what Eye Can Dance is. And I think that's what's made it what it is, and that it belongs to the community, is that my story has intertwined with their story, and together we've shaped this. I speak a lot about that with Emily, who's a young woman who has been at Eye Can Dance since she was really little and is now, in 20 years old, studying law at university. And she does a lot of young ambassador work for Eye Can Dance. And her and I often talk about how our stories shaped each other, how she spoke to me about what she needed, what it felt like, what she wanted. And I responded to that in the movement and in the shaping of organizations growing. And that story can be told numerous times by every one of the children that have stepped in. And in many ways, I feel like Eye Can Dance is a bit of an elastic band, is that it has a clear shape. There is a clear shape of who we are, what we do, and how we do it, but that we can stretch according to who steps into the community. And that is true community, is you shape around each other. It's not this static, rigid thing. I think that's the problem, is that we're caught up in systems that are static and are rigid. And until there's fluidity, we will constantly knock against the sides.
That's so true. And I think that it's not even that they're static in terms of like being the here and now. I feel like they're always behind the here and now, the systems and that we interact with. It's like it takes such a long time for things to evolve to suit the needs of those who need them.
And even then, that it feels like they're boxed in. So you're placed into a box, and moving away or out of that box or to a different box is just impossible.
Yeah.
So yeah. I love this concept of the elastic band. It really does make sense.
Hmm.
Where do you see Eye Can Dance going? What is your dream scenario? What is the future of Eye Can Dance?
My dream scenario is that we have a home. And that home is a space which is a creative community that is interspersed between people with disabilities, people without disabilities, people coming and exploring and being creative and engaging with each other and shaping each other in ways of what it is to be in community. And that there's this just a constant growth of sharing, and that we're learning from each other, that that the young people are leading us. The young people are telling us what Eye Can Dance needs and putting their ideas forward. And we are then supporting them to make that happen. Their families are involved. Their families are building and creating. It's a place where you arrive and you know that I immediately belong, no matter the differences that I bring along with me. And that can look like so many different offers. But it's about a place. I dream of a place.
Sounds like utopia. It sounds amazing. Can we come? I mean, so Eye Can Dance is in London, and we'll have people listening who are not in London. We might have people listening who are also looking to like drive community. What would be your advice to other people who maybe want to create their version of what you've created? Organizations trying to build more community around disabled children and their families.
I just firstly just don't give up. It's really hard work building and creating, especially at these times that we're in now, around cuts and funding, cost of living crisis. And I think for me, it's about listening to who your community are. Let it be shaped by them. Let them be part of it. I think it's really important. I don't want to ever franchise Icon Dolls. I remember when we spoke about growth, there was a discussion like, oh, do you want to create an Icon Dolls south of London? Do you want to go and create it in other parts of the country? And actually, I don't want to do that. Icon Dolls for me is about the people in which I've created it with and who are around me in the community that it is now. It's very specific to where it is. The concepts, the principles, the values, that can be shared. And yes, that's my goal, is that, and that's what my research is about, is that these ideals and the learnings and the framework that I'll hopefully one day be able to publish and share, that can go anywhere and can transcend any culture or space and time and language. But that actually you then apply that where you are. I don't want to hold on it onto anything that's so tightly that it's like, oh, it belongs to me. The whole point of me creating this is so that it belongs to everyone and that we share it. It's hard work. It's hard work being a working mom. It's hard work having a belief and fighting for it. It's tiring. I encourage whoever, anyone who is building and has a vision, to make sure you've got people around you that can help you do it and that will encourage you and believe in you.
Yeah. What do you do to kind of switch off from everything, Juliet? Who is Juliet when she's not mum, academic, Icon Dolls founder and CEO? Who are you outside of all of these things?
I'm a dancer.
Ah, you dance. Good answer. I set you up for that one. Of course you do.
And it's the truth.
I'm sure.
At the end of the day, I'm just a dancer with a dream.
Oh, beautiful. What would you say to like parents who are like, dance, like, you know, movement psychotherapy? What is there any advice, you know, to parents or families out there to how to kind of think about movement and dance with their children, you know, just on a very micro level?
Incorporate it into the daily.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that's one of the reasons I created the Icon Dolls approach, was to be able, because dance movement psychotherapy in itself can look quite clinical if it's done in its purest form. And I suppose my application of it in Icon Dolls is bringing it into the community and using it with the combination of the other strategies and tools. And I think it's really important that we remember that our bodies are tools and that they are creative and that our children are like tape recorders. They're recording everything as they're going through the world. They're feeling it, they're moving it, and so are we. And so how can we respond to it? So what are we holding in our bodies, and how does that impact on our relationship with our child? And then also, what are our children holding in their bodies, and what are their bodies telling us? I think so often we can be so informed by what needs to be done. We need to go brush teeth, we need to wash face, we need to get pajamas on, I need to move you, I need to shift you, I need to... But actually, what are our bodies saying, and what does it feel like if we stopped and listened, and if we felt? Because we feel everything first, then we put it into the cognitive sense. And we assess things from a non-verbal way all the time. We just don't realize it's a tool that we're using. And so, yes, and also just the creativity of it. I love the fact that we can just be. And I see that even with my own children. I'm very playful with my children through creative ways. And that becomes our little story. And I think sometimes parents forget that we need to do. So what does it feel like just to be?
Oh, that's gorgeous. I did try this with Lua, because she can become quite overwhelmed with things. And because she's nonverbal, then it turns into like a screaming match or she gets very upset. And there was a point where she was like pulling her hair out. But I started to just sit. So if she was getting upset, and her favorite thing is to sit on my lap. So sitting on the floor on my lap and just like stopping, and the immediate change in her
behavior. It was like, oh, I do have the space to stop and really think about what it is that's happening in my emotions and why am I, what is it that I really want? Where previously you're always thinking of like, she's upset because X. Mm. I need to do X because she's Y.
Mm.
But just that like 3 minutes of just sitting, like even last night, she was just like, I wanted to turn off the TV because it was like bath time, da da da. And she like had a meltdown because she didn't understand what was going on. But just sitting on my lap for a minute and just being quiet and just, and then she understood, okay, fine. Yes, I am tired, which is why I'm upset. And so she started to sign for tired and she started to sign for bath time. Yeah, it was so fascinating.
Beautiful. Yeah. Like, take a breath.
Yeah.
And a moment to just be. And yeah, it can be very calming.
Yeah, you created that space. I think even as women, we don't always do that with each other. You know, it's always so filled with words and busyness or telling something. And what does it feel like just to be? And then get a sense of where each other's at.
Mm.
And actually sometimes you'll discover something you didn't actually see, but you feel.
Yeah. Oh my God, yes. Happy International Women's Day. We're recording this on International Women's Day, so let's just take a moment with each other to sense where we're at and be. Yeah, or be and then sense where we're at.
Mm.
I like that.
Really nice. Are there things that you've learned from working with parents and your own research that you'd like to share?
I am fascinated by this area that I think is actually really under-researched. I think one of the biggest things for me is how important the parent's voice is and how often parents don't feel that their voice is heard. And through that research, just by offering them opportunities to be heard, that in itself is just like, well, thank you. Thank you for listening. And all those parents are going, okay, so where will this go? Will this make that difference? And at Arc and Dance, we've done various bits of research, some on the parent therapy groups that we run. And we've got a paper that is sort of in the process of being completed. And at the moment, we have another bit of research that we're doing in partnership with Goldsmiths University, where we're analyzing over 20 interviews with parents, just talking about how they've managed the last few years, cost of living, pandemic, and what did that look like in how they looked after themselves. And it's always shocking to just discover each of their stories and what they've had to manage and how important it was for them to be able to be listened to at this point and an absolute hope that they're adding their voice will make a difference. And we really hope that what we gather will be able to be the beginning of quite a few sort of projects around making sure that that parent voice is heard. I always find it fascinating that whilst every parent's story is different, how many connected themes there are. And one of those is the fight, just the constant fight, the constant struggle, and the absolute lack of ability to stop. Because there's just no end to what their child needs. I think those ongoing themes of just the overwhelmment and the fear of the unknown, what lies ahead, those types of things.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that we found really important in the research we did with the parent therapy groups is the value of each other. How so often they would say what it felt like to step into a space that they just knew there was no judgment, that they could say anything and that they didn't have to explain it and they didn't have to feel that they needed to clarify what their child's behavior was or why they responded. And I think that power of each other and of hearing each other, that for me is a truly a gift to be part of.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, hopefully that's what the fucking novel is about as well. It's, you know,
offering that space to be yourself as a Zen parent.
Yeah, with no judgment. Absolutely no judgment. Thank you, Julia. Wonderful. It's been so lovely talking to you. I feel so lucky that
we have you in our lives, that B's yes. able to attend I Can Dance, and she gets so much joy out of it. And it's a real place of love, which is what you want it to be. So that's lovely. And thank you for talking to us yeah. today.
Honestly, it's been beautiful. Yeah. You've said some really like profound things, and yeah.
But to end, yes. just to go from the profound and the beautiful to slightly more
scummy,
blunt and sweary, we always ask our guests, what is their fucking normal? So, Juliet, what is your fucking normal?
I think my normal's become that anywhere can become a space that you can make things happen. And I relate that to the fact that I have turned a Great Ormond Street toilet cubicle into a fantastic meeting room. And that is the absolute truth. So anywhere can be a place that you can make things possible.
Oh, I love, I love that.
That's perfect. Gorgeous. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the Fucking Normal podcast. We love making this podcast.
Yes, we do.
We're part of a much bigger team, almost exclusively all parents of disabled children. And our goal is to reach as many people as possible and create a community of support for parents and carers who share our experiences.
So if you've liked what you've heard, please like and subscribe so that we can reach out to more people. You can find more information on this and other episodes at fuckingnormalpodcast.com. That's fkingnormalpodcast.com. You can join us on Facebook and on Instagram at fuckingnormal_podcast. That's fkingnormal_podcast. You can get all the links and more information in the show notes below.
So thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time.
Bye.